Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we are focusing on something that's often invisible, but absolutely critical. The backbone of modern society.
Industrial Control Systems, or ICS.
Exactly. We're not talking about your office email server here. We're talking about the deep infrastructure that keeps the lights on, the water flowing, and our factories running.
That's right. And when these systems, you know, the power grids, the chemical plants, water facilities, when they come up in security talks, it's usually about physical defense, fences, gates, network segmentation.
But our sources today pull us much deeper, right into the software itself.
Mm-hmm.
So our mission for this deep dive is to get a really quick but thorough understanding of the cybersecurity risks that are baked into that ICS software, especially the legacy code running deep inside these operational technology or OT environments.
And we really need to figure out why the standard fixes, the policy-based fixes, just don't work here.
Right. And what technical measures are actually required to meet these, I mean, incredibly demanding global compliance standards.
Exactly. The central reality you have to face is that these ICS systems rely on these incredibly complex layered software stacks.
Just layers and layers of code.
And a lot of that code is old. I mean, really old. A lot of it is sourced from third parties, built with ancient tool chains. It just creates this massive ongoing software integrity challenge.
So the goal has to be more than just writing policies.
Way beyond that. It has to be about fundamentally improving the integrity, the transparency, and the resilience of the software itself. That's the only way to meet standards like IEC 62443 or NIST 882.
Okay, so we're going to explore those hidden risks, that digital to physical threat, and then look at the regulatory pressure that's forcing change. And then we'll pivot to two core technical capabilities that can actually close these gaps.
We're talking runtime code hardening and build-time software bill of materials, or SBOMs.
Right. So let's start there. Let's define the environment. Why is securing an ICS environment so, so different from just securing a regular corporate IT network?
Well, it really comes down to the operational constraints. They're just on another level.
You can't just tell a power plant operator to, you know, take their main control system offline Tuesday night for patching.
You absolutely cannot. The constraints that define this environment, it's a combination of unique factors. First, you've got the networks themselves.
They're air-gapped, right?
Often air-gapped or maybe intermittently connected. So that immediately kills any idea of centralized cloud-based security or automated updates. It's just not possible.
Okay, what's next?
Second is the hardware. We're talking about fleets of multi-vendor devices, PLCs.
Programmable logic controllers.
Exactly. And these things might be running firmware that's 10, maybe even 20 years old.
Which means vendor support is probably long gone.
Long gone. And the systems were never, ever designed with modern security in mind. Then there's the third constraint, which is performance.
Real-time requirements.
Absolutely. If a security scan or some integrity check introduces even a few milliseconds of latency, the physical process can fail. You just can't tolerate the kind of overhead that comes with traditional security scanning.
So you're dealing with hundreds of different versions of equipment, inconsistent update workflows, and zero tolerance for downtime.
It's a security nightmare.
And this is where it gets really important for you, the listener, because this ICS software, it's interacting directly with physical equipment. We're talking valves, turbines, pumps.
Mm-hmm.
The consequences of a software flaw or a successful attack, they aren't just data breaches. They are high-stakes, potentially catastrophic physical events.
That is the critical distinction. A vulnerability in the digital world translates directly into a physical consequence.
Like what, specifically?
We're talking about manipulating process parameters in a refinery, forcing an immediate shutdown of a production line, causing equipment damage that costs millions, and, critically, safety incidents that impact human operators. The risk here is not abstract at all.
Software risk is both digital and physical.
And it's immediate. Now, when we look at where this risk comes from, our sources point to two big factors. The first is vulnerabilities that are just deeply nested in the components themselves.
What do you mean by that?
Well, a single device, like a controller, it can have dozens, maybe hundreds of internal and external software elements, and many of them are proprietary, or they just don't have clear update mechanisms. If you don't know what's inside, you can't secure it.
And that leads right to the second problem.
The supply chain blind spot.
Right. It's all these third-party libraries, compiled code, black box binaries from vendors.
And without a reliable software bill of materials, an SBOM, operators have absolutely no idea what libraries are inside that firmware.
So a new vulnerability is announced, say in some open source library.
And they can't can't assess their exposure. They have no idea if that vulnerable code is packaged deep inside their controller firmware. It turns vulnerability management and compliance into, well, impossible guesswork, and it just grinds incident response to a halt.
So we've laid out how difficult the environment is, the supply chain complexity. But where are the attackers actually hitting? What's the number one technical weak spot they keep going after?
And that brings us, unfortunately, to a very old friend in the security world. It's the biggest technical vulnerability we see in critical infrastructure today.
Which is?
Memory safety issues.
The classic flaw. You're kidding me. Buffer overflows, use after free. It sounds like something from a textbook 20 years ago.
It does, but they still dominate the vulnerability lists in the ICS space.
Why? Why haven't we moved past these foundational errors?
Because memory safety flaws, buffer overflows, out-of-bounds writes, they are just incredibly reliable ways to get an exploit to work. They let attackers hijack a device's execution flow.
Which lets them run their own code.
Remote code execution, multi-stage exploit chains, they account for a massive percentage of recorded CVEs, the common vulnerabilities, and exposures.
And this persistence problem, I'm guessing it ties right back to those legacy constraints we talked about.
Precisely. Many of these industrial devices are written in older languages like C and C++, say, which are, you know, inherently vulnerable to these flaws. They require manual memory management.
So you combine that with patching being impossible because of uptime.
And the fact that the firmware often can't be rebuilt or re-verified by the operator, you just have a perfect storm. Old foundational vulnerabilities that live on forever.
So it really sounds like the policy of the patching mechanisms, they've just completely outpace the actual technical reality on the ground.
They absolutely have. And the complexity of the supply chain means these vulnerabilities are often introduced long before the operator even gets the product.
I think we have a source on this that really drives it home.
We do. There's a really memorable detail here that shows the scale of the problem. Andy Kling, he's the VP of cybersecurity at Schneider Electric. He found that memory safety was, and I'm quoting, easily the largest percentage of recorded security issues they
saw. That's the largest percentage.
And here's the kicker. A staggering 94% of those weaknesses originated from third-party components.
94%.
94.
That figure alone should terrify anyone running critical infrastructure. It confirms the biggest risk isn't some internal mistake. It's the code you inherit from your supply chain.
That's the key takeaway. You have to focus on the integrity of what you inherit.
Okay, that sets the stage perfectly for the regulatory pressure. Now that we've defined the risk, let's shift gears and look at the compliance maze. What are these global frameworks actually demanding in terms of technical controls?
This is where the rubber meets the road, because these frameworks are moving past paper checklists. They're demanding demonstrable security built into the product.
Okay, like what? Give me an example.
Take IEC 62443. It's the global standard for industrial cybersecurity. It defines security levels SL1 through SL4.
Right.
Specifically, security requirement 3.4 requires mechanisms to ensure software integrity. That means you must detect and prevent unauthorized modifications, especially against zero-day exploits.
So if your system can't stop a memory-based zero-day, you're not meeting that requirement. It doesn't matter how good your documentation is.
Exactly. Then you've got the U.S. standards. NIST 882 is the guide for ICS and OT. It requires controls focused heavily on system integrity, or SI, and configuration management, supported by continuous monitoring.
And for the utilities, there's NERC CIP.
Right, for the bulk electric system. NERC CIP mandates stringent security monitoring and incident response. It specifically requires operators to have supporting data for incident response under CIP 008.
Meaning if something happens, you need immediate verifiable data.
You need to know what was running, how it behaved, what was impacted, and that demands technical capabilities that are often just impossible with old black box firmware.
And beyond the US, this pressure for transparency is just accelerating everywhere.
Everywhere. The EU Cyber Resilience Act, the CRA, is probably the biggest global shift we've seen. It imposes mandatory security and transparency requirements on manufacturers selling into the EU.
It forces them to deal with that 94% third-party risk.
Head on. They have to provide comprehensive SBOM documentation and follow secure by design principles.
And at the same time, you have U.S. federal mandates from NTIA, DHS, DOD, all requiring accurate machine-readable SBOMs.
It's no longer okay to provide a partial ingredient list. And this is echoed by things like the UK's Cybersecurity and Resilience Bill. The message from every major regulator is clear. You must know what's in your software, and that software must be demonstrably resilient.
Okay, so we've established that compliance requires technical solutions, not just more policies. Let's dig into the two technical pillars our sources highlight.
The first pillar is all about that visibility. It's about satisfying those transparency mandates. We're talking build time SBOM generation.
This is the identify capability that every standard seems to want now.
It is, and the mechanism is crucial. You have to embed SBOM generation directly into the CI/CD pipeline or into the vendor's build environment.
And that produces what exactly? A truly useful SBOM.
It produces comprehensive Cyclone DX compliant SBOMs. Cyclone DX is an open standard that supports all the mandatory NTIA fields, components, versions, vulnerabilities.
But the real value here is for the operator, right?
Absolutely. For the operator, this means full component visibility. Libraries, files, versions, even proprietary components inside a compiled binary. It lets them audit supplier code and rapidly assess their exposure the second a new vulnerability is announced.
So it stops compliance from being pure guesswork. It gives them that verifiable digital ingredient label.
That's the perfect way to put it.
Okay, that covers visibility. But that doesn't stop an attack. It just tells you where the holes are. So the second pillar has to be about directly stopping the exploit.
And that's runtime code protection. This is the protect capability. It meets those strict integrity requirements like IEC 62443SR 3.4 and the NIST SI controls.
And what's needed here is a solution that can harden a system against memory-based exploits without a full redesign.
Exactly. The specific mechanism that's highlighted is applying load time function randomization, or LFR.
LFR. Okay, that's a critical term. How does randomization actually defeat an attack, like a buffer overflow? And how can it work on old compiled code?
It's a fantastic question. It's essentially about disrupting the attacker's plan. A successful memory attack depends on the attacker knowing exactly where their target function or data is in the device's memory.
They need a fixed address to jump to.
They need a fixed address. LFR works by dynamically loading and relocating all the executable functions and critical data into new random memory locations every single time the device restarts.
So the attacker who spent weeks crafting an exploit for a specific memory address suddenly finds that address is different every single time.
It's different every time. They can't reliably jump to the function they want to execute. It doesn't patch the vulnerability per se, but it makes the vulnerability virtually unexploitable.
That's a game changer because it protects devices in the field against 0 days, even before a patch is even developed.
And that brings us back to the legacy problem.
Right. I have to challenge this. How can you apply something like LFR to decades-old, air-gapped PLC firmware without breaking it or needing the original vendor?
That's the key enabling technology. Modern solutions that do this, they do it at the binary level.
So you don't need the source code.
You don't need the source code. The mitigation is applied directly to the compiled binaries, the legacy firmware, the vendor-supplied software. You harden that binary, and then you deploy it using your standard maintenance procedures.
So you can proactively protect that legacy PLC in an air-gapped network. You reduce the risk while maintaining operational continuity. That flexibility is absolutely essential for OT.
It makes exploit mitigation a reality, not just a theoretical goal. And finally, the third supporting step is just continuous monitoring.
Right. You still need to see what's happening.
You need lightweight monitoring on the device to capture crash indicators, detect unusual behavior, which all feeds back into those NIST and NRC CIP requirements for monitoring and incident response.
So this whole deep dive really shows that securing ICS demands moving protection inside the software itself. That's a huge shift.
It is. It has to cover legacy devices, modern platforms, and those incredibly complex supply chains. Paper compliance is now being backed up by mandatory technical defense.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, it seems compliance with these major standards just demands more than checklists. It demands protections that actually reduce the odds of an exploit working in the field.
Visibility is essential, yes. But integrity and resilience, that's the final defensive layer.
So what does all this mean for you? Well, if memory safety flaws are proven to be the largest percentage of digital security issues in critical infrastructure, and we know these flaws carry severe physical consequences, will future global regulations shift?
That's a good question.
Will they move from merely mandating SBOMs, which is just visibility, to mandating strict technical requirements for binary hardening, which is actual exploit mitigation? That's something to mull over as you consider the future of critical system resilience and just how quickly regulators will start demanding real technical defense, not just disclosure.